Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Enhancing the Service Array in Child Welfare conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your host for today's conference, Ms. Mary O'Brien. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you. My name is Mary O'Brien, and on behalf of the National Child Welfare Resource Center for Organizational Improvement, we want to welcome everyone to today's call on Enhancing the Service Array in Child Welfare. I'm going to turn this over in a minute to Steve Priester, who's an Associate Director of the National Child Welfare Resource Center for Organizational Improvement, and he's going to be moderating today's call. But before we do that, I'll just tell you a little bit more about who's on the line and go over some logistics. We have with us as presenters today a team of people who have been working on the service array process around the country. Steve Priester will be speaking about the process along with a couple of other people. We have Joe Murray from the National Resource Center for Child Welfare Data and Technology, and we have John Baumgartner, who's working with the National Resource Center for Organizational Improvement as a consultant. We also have, from the state of West Virginia, Melanie Swisher, who will be talking about the work that they've done in West Virginia on implementing the service array process. Melanie is the Community Collaborative Partnership Coordinator in the Division of Children and Adult Services in West Virginia, so we're really glad that she's here with us as well. We have a large number of people registered for today's call from state and county child welfare agencies, providers and universities, important partners in states, and also a number of people from our ACF regional offices. So we welcome everyone to today's call. As the operator said, we're leaving the lines in a listen-only mode just so we won't have a lot of background noise. But if you, for any reason, you're having trouble connecting or listening, you know, hearing what's going on, do try to use that star zero on your phone to talk to the operator. And we will be opening the line a couple times for questions, and we really do want this to be interactive. So please jot down any thoughts or comments or questions that you have, and you'll have an opportunity to ask those. I wanted to say before we begin that the handouts for today's call are on our website. The email that you got with the call-in information mentioned these handouts, in particular a PowerPoint that the presenters will be speaking from today. So I'm going to give you that website again where you can get these handouts if you haven't accessed them yet and are at a computer. Or if you're not, maybe you can get them afterwards. The website is www.nrcoi.org. So that's National Resource Center for Organizational Improvement, nrcoi.org. When you get there, if you click on teleconferences and today's date, you'll find the handouts for today's call. There's a PowerPoint, as I mentioned. There's a document that's called Agenda and Contact Information, which has the contact information for everyone who will be speaking today. And there's also a document called Service Array Training Modules, which is an overview of all of the training modules around Service Array that are available on our website. That document will link you right to that page that has all of those Service Array training materials. There's also a number of background materials listed on this website that about the Service Array process. So, as I say, welcome to everyone. And with that, I think I'm going to turn it over to Steve to begin.
Hi, everybody. We're going to talk today about enhancing the service array in child welfare. We're going to talk about both assessing the current service array as well as creating and implementing a resource and capacity development plan. Now, I want to say right up front that this process, which we've now used in a number of states, is a process that's been designed by two national resource centers, both Organizational Improvement and Data and Technology, and that's why this conference is co-sponsored by both resource centers. We've been helping states assess their service array and improve their service array now for 7 or 8 years, but a year ago we made some major changes to the process that we had been using, and the first state to implement the new service array process is West Virginia, and that's why I'm so pleased that Melanie Swisher could be on the call today, so they'll be able to talk about their experience in West Virginia. Myself, John Baumgartner, and Joe Murray are going to first start going through the PowerPoint presentation. Then we'll we'll open it up for some questions. Then we'll talk about technical assistance on the service array process, and again, open it up for questions. But I also want to say before I forget that in addition to the handouts that Mary talked about, if you go to our website, nrcoi.org, up in the right-hand corner of the home page is a search engine. If you type in service array, it'll take you to an area that has over 50 tools and documents that we've developed in the service array process. So, John, would you start us out and take us through the first slides?
Yes, I'm going to start on slide two for everybody that has the PowerPoint presentation. And there's really two main goals of the service array process. The first one is to assess a jurisdiction's service array. And this basically means, does the jurisdiction have the capacity to achieve positive outcomes for children and families? There's four elements to this assessment. There's an assessment of the child welfare practice, an assessment of leadership and culture, an assessment of current services in the service array, and then also a review of any needed new services. The second main goal of the service array process is to create and implement a resource and capacity development plan to enhance a jurisdiction's capacity to achieve positive outcomes. Really, step one, you know, is the assessment. Step two is the creation and implementation of this resource and capacity development plan. On slide three, there's a number of slides three and four, there's a number of reasons that this service array process was designed to meet. One is to engage the state's leaders as active stakeholders in the development and provision of outcomes-based services for children and families in the system. We want to enhance relationships across a number of different agencies, working relationships. We want to clarify for leaders the importance of their participation in improving the child welfare system, which will benefit all of their work. We also created this to assist internal and external community stakeholders in formulating the core values and principles that need to guide the work of the child welfare system. We wanted to address practice at both the casework and the system levels. We wanted to provide a mechanism through which a jurisdiction at the local level can continually assess and enhance its capacity. In other words, we didn't want this to be a one-time and done event, but a more of continuous improvement. We wanted to build states, a tribe, stakeholders' capacity at the system level to assess and enhance the service array on an ongoing basis. And then lastly, we wanted this process to be able to build off of existing needs assessments that have already been done. There's a number of requirements for the service array process. One is that it's built on the fact that jurisdictions must meet the individualized needs of children, youth, and families in the child welfare system. It's also predicated on the establishment of a child welfare practice model along the CFSR, the Child and Family Services Review, particularly family-centered, community-based, individualized services, and enhanced parental capacity. The process must be data-driven so that jurisdictions and states can assess and improve performance utilizing outcome measurements in the CFSR. It's got to be collaborative in nature, and it necessitates the building, strengthening, and maintaining of a collaborative in the jurisdiction. It's also built on the recognition that state, tribal, and community stakeholders, along with state or local child welfare program, hold ownership over the outcomes for children and families and must share responsibilities in those outcomes.
Okay, this is Steve again. I'll talk a while. You know, for those of you in child welfare who know about the Child and Family Services Review, we're in our second round of reviews now, in the second year of the second round, and in the Child and Family Services Review, states evaluate themselves, as do their federal partners, on their meeting of seven outcomes and seven systemic factors. The systemic factors are the infrastructure a child welfare system needs to have in place in order to achieve good outcomes. Well, one of the seven systemic factors is the service array. And so I thought it'd be helpful for people to see the three items or indicators that states must be in substantial conformity in order to be successful in that review. There's three items, items 35, 36, and 37. The first is that the state has to have in place an array of services that really sort of go across the whole continuum from prevention to remediation. So there's got to be an array of services, and Item 36, those services are accessible to families in all the jurisdictions in the state. And item 37, this is most important, those services have to be able to be individualized to meet the unique needs of children and families served by the agency, and that's a real issue in a lot of places. So those are the CFSR requirements. Now, if you look at slide number 8, we'll take a look at the results of the CFSR in the first round, and these are the 7 systemic factors, and the 2 systemic factors the states had the most difficult with were the case review system and the service array. So in the service array, only about 22 or 23 of the 50 states and Puerto Rico and the District of Columbia were in substantial conformity. The rest of the states were rated areas needing, this was an area needing improvement. 23 had to improve. And so far in the second round of the Child and Family Services Review, a number of the states are having difficulty meeting the challenges of this systemic factor. Now, in that first round of Child and Family Services Review, as we looked at the states who then, in their program improvement plan, were able to be more successful in the service array, there are some lessons learned. The first lesson is that if you're going to have a good, effective service array system, you need to engage your stakeholders frequently on a routine basis. After all, it is your stakeholders that are your partners in service delivery, and so they really have to be treated as partners if we're going to have an effective service array system. States that were successful really did a philosophical shift and really focused on collaboration. Most importantly, if we're going to be successful in having an effective service array system, it needs to be addressed. The problems that state has in its service array need to be addressed in a strategic plan, not just a piecemeal approach. You cannot fix the service array by saying, oh, we'll tinker with this service or we'll tinker with that service, but you really need to do an overall strategic approach to change it. And finally, we've learned that if the leadership of the agency is not behind improving the service array, it's not going to happen. So those are the lessons that we learned from the first round of the Child and Family Services Review. On slide 10 is a outline of the 7 steps in the service array process that we use. We're going to spend some time on each of those, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this slide. But first of all, if we're going to do the service array process throughout the whole state, there needs to be a state-level service array steering committee that includes not only child welfare, but the courts, mental health, education, domestic violence, substance abuse, and so forth. There also has to be a parallel structure at the jurisdictional level. We call that the Community Service Array Steering Committee. And that local Service Array Steering Committee really helps to convene all the stakeholders into what we call a Community Stakeholder Collaborative. Step 3 is the actual assessment process. Step 4 is the creation of the resource and capacity development plan based on what was learned in the assessment process. And then we begin implementation, which continues on for a period of time. When we form the State Service Array Steering Committee, the initial membership is a bit small, but we'll expand it a bit later. I'll explain that. But we need to include at least the child welfare leadership team, program staff, contract management staff, since this has to do with services, financial staff, data and technology staff, and QA/CQI staff. And that group of people with technical assistance will develop a work plan and a timetable to implement the service array in the state, including the selection and recruitment of a pilot jurisdiction to begin the process. And then the National Resource Centers, the 2 of them, will provide technical assistance for the pilot jurisdiction. And then the other jurisdictions will participate in that pilot so that they can learn how to do the process, kind of a train-the-trainer approach, which builds the capacity in the state. And that state steering committee also needs to create a child and family snapshot for use in the jurisdictions, and Joe Murray from Data and Technology Resource Center is going to talk about that now.
Thanks, Steve. Looking at slide 13, and first let me mention, John and Steve will be talking in detail a little later about assessing capacities. But generally, the capacities being assessed mirror the CFSR outcomes, two related to safety, two to permanency, and three to well-being. Each jurisdiction or site involved in the service array process may elect to focus on one or more of these capacities. One of the requirements mentioned for the service array process is that it be data-driven. Data is used in the statewide assessment for the CFSR to inform an assessment of each item and outcome at the state level. In a similar vein, the Child and Family Snapshot is intended to provide data which will serve to inform the assessment and planning processes at the site level. So the data must be site-specific. In designing a template for the snapshot, then, the State Steering Committee is determining what site-specific information can be provided to each site as it engages in the process. The information must be usable by the site in conducting assessments of the specific capacities it has selected. Looking at the next slide, primary sources of data include the state agency's data system and, in many states, results from its QA or CQI processes. Data from other sources, some of which could be site-specific, can also be incorporated in the snapshot. These include existing needs assessments. We anticipate that a single or multiple counties will comprise each site involved in the process. Common data sources among the states include the National Child Abuse and Neglect Data System, NCANS, and the Adoption and Foster Care Analysis and Reporting System, AFCARS. Both of these contain county-level data. In order to assist in the development of the Child and Family Snapshot, the National Resource Center for Child Welfare Data and Technology has developed a utility using SPSS code, which a state can use to extract core data from NCANS and AFCAR submissions. The nature of this core data is similar to that found in the state data profiles provided by the Children's Bureau, and it provides a picture of the children and families coming into the child welfare system in the jurisdiction, what they look like, and what's bringing them into the system. NRCCWDT is currently working on its website, and the utility will be available from that site in the near future. Until then, anyone wanting a copy can contact me, Joe Murray, using the contact information provided in the agenda for this teleconference. John?
Thanks, Joe. I'm going back now to slide 15, because what we had is we had this smaller state-level steering committee to really get the housework done, which is selecting the pilot or recruiting the pilot jurisdiction and then producing the child and family snapshot. Now, once that housekeeping work is done in step one, we're going to continue to work together, we're going to expand that state steering committee, because as we get down to the service array assessment in a local jurisdiction, if there's not cooperation and collaboration between some of the major service areas, such as the child welfare, children's mental health, the courts, and so forth, it's the job of the state steering committee, the expanded state steering committee, to kind of knock heads together at the local level to get people to the table. So there's on slide 15, you see a list of the people that we add to the state steering committee at this point in time, courts, tribes, child abuse prevention, and so forth. You can take a look at that slide at your leisure. And then when that larger group convenes, we go through a process really of reaching a consensus on the statewide philosophy, values, and principles of the child welfare system. And the resource centers help do that. Now, I thought we'd take a minute here to ask Melanie Swisher from West Virginia to talk about West Virginia's experience up to this point in time in the service array process.
Steve, this is Paul DiLorenzo. I just wanted to let you know I was able to join on. Sorry I'm late.
That's great, Paul. Paul, if you look at at the agenda, you see a Paul DiLorenzo, who is the Senior Director of Strategic Consulting with KC Family Programs, has been working with us in West Virginia and elsewhere to on the service array process, and he had some other meetings. We didn't know if he could join us, but I'm so glad you're here, Paul.
Thank you.
Melanie?
Yes. Okay, I will talk a little bit about the development of our state steering team in West Virginia. One of the things that we were clear on was exactly who needed to be on board at the table for our state steering team. What we knew that we would have difficulty doing would be creating a new committee, because we have the same people or the movers and shakers in area, and they just have meeting after meeting. So what we did was we looked for an existing group that met the criteria, and we had one, and our job was just to convince them to take on the task of West Virginia Service Array process as part of what they were doing. The group that we chose was the West Virginia System of Care State Implementation Team, because we felt like they had the desired membership, including family input, the Big Four, we call the Big Four, which is the Department, Education, the Courts, Juvenile Justice, and Mental Health, and they had a cross-agency and a cross-bureau buy-in. So they had the membership that we wanted. They had the same philosophy. I mean, the family-centered practice, they had the system of care, they had the individualized service, community-based. They had the philosophy we wanted. All we needed to do was get buy-in from them, and we were able to go to their meeting and sell them on the idea. The only request that they had was that we create an ad hoc committee, smaller subcommittee, that could do the day-to-day decisions and then take the larger decisions to the SIT group, the big state implementation team group. They also had a stipulation that there'd be a point person, and the point person's job would be to report back to the group and would be to ensure that the membership included everyone that needed to be there, you know, adding domestic violence representatives and all the ones that Steve just went over. And we had a point person that was one of the requirements from our last CFSR in the PIP program improvement suggested a state representative whose job it is to coordinate the community and regional initiatives. So that person, which happened to be me, was assigned the job as a point person for the state steering team committee. And one of the reasons that we wanted also to get an established group is because of not starting from scratch on the trust issue, and they have a relationship. They've worked together for years, and we're not building a new committee where we spend a lot of valuable time building trust and learning about each other and learning how to work together. That was already established, which means we could hit the ground running with our project.
I just want to add that is a tremendous advantage. So if you have an existing group at the state level where some of these people are already meeting and have relationships, it's really more effective to use that group and build on that group, because you'll save a lot of time. You've got those relationships already formed. Thank you so much, Melanie. Let's go to John now.
Okay, and I'm going to talk a little bit after you get your state service array steering committee up and running and they do their work plan. The next step in the process is to create the community steering committee, and I'm on slide 16 here. So we have the creation of a community-level steering committee in the pilot jurisdiction, and we want multidisciplinary membership just as we do with the state steering committee. And again, we want a point person or a focal person that's really going to be the organ, you know, the grassroots organization behind the steering committee. They're also going to complete a work plan in conjunction with the state level steering committee that will lead the jurisdiction through the service array process. Slide 17 talks a little bit or reviews on what's exactly in that work plan, and I'm going to walk through a couple of those real quickly. The first is a review of the statewide philosophy, values, and principles that the statewide committee or the state steering committee did. There's also a tailored training, and there was a document on the webpage, and it's also on the nrcoi.org webpage that has 10 training modules that can be used for the community steering committee. We'd like to review the existing needs assessments conducted in the jurisdiction, because one frustration often in this process can be if a group has already done certain things and that information is ignored. So we want to make sure that information is included in this process and we build off of that information. The community steering committee will also prepare a child and family snapshot similar to what Joe just talked to, but at a local level, maybe drill down a little bit further with the data. Then they're also going to start working on recruiting and retaining a wide range of traditional and non-traditional stakeholders to build what we're calling a community stakeholder collaborative. They will also want to discuss and plan on how to involve birth parents, family caregivers, and youth. The rationale behind the community stakeholder collaborative, there's a number of them on slide 18. First, no individual knows all the services and supports, and we want a collective pooling of knowledge. No one agency by itself can ensure safety, permanency, and well-being, so we want this to be a collaborative effort, interagency. Also, by creating a community stakeholder collaborative or building off of an existing one, we can create a constituency for child welfare. And then also creating, this helps to create more effective community partnerships so that the coordination and integration of services can happen over the life of this process. Slide 19 runs through a number of different types of stakeholders that we like to see in the community stakeholder collaborative, and I'm not going to go through each one of these specifically, but there's a number here. You want your public and private providers, you want birth parents, family caregivers, kinship care, adoptive families, youth, the courts, the legal side, CASA volunteers, tribal representatives, mental health, substance abuse, educators, child abuse prevention, other key providers like housing, food resources, elected officials, administrators, business organizations, maybe Chamber of Commerce, something like that, media, faith-based organizations, community-based organizations like United Way or any other local foundations. So you really build that community stakeholder collaborative, and you want a number of diverse stakeholders in that. On slide 22, this is a basic breakdown of the work plan, or real basic breakdown of the work plan for the community stakeholder collaborative. There's going to be three key or core meetings followed up by quarterly meetings after this third meeting. The first meeting is full day. It's a full day. It involves the engagement of the stakeholders, any training that needs to be done, and then the beginning of the assessment process of the four different types of assessments, which Steve is going to talk about in a second. The second meeting is a full day, and we report out the strengths and weaknesses in the capacities that the jurisdiction's assessing. And then the third meeting is the finalization of the capacity and resource development plan. After the third meeting, after that plan is adopted, then the quarterly meetings are held to monitor implementation and for any work group assignments in regards to implementing the strategies in the capacity and resource development plan. And with that, I think we're going to let Melanie have Melanie talk a little bit about the community stakeholder collaborative and the community steering committee processes in West Virginia.
Okay, thanks, John. We in developing our community steering committees, we were once again lucky that we had started a process back in the 1990s. The Bureau for Children and Families partnered with the community, and we established what we called community collaboratives. And their purpose in the 1990s was to assure timely, seamless community response for child safety and initial assessment, and they partnered with us to assess the communities and look at gaps in services. So we felt like this was a perfect group to take on this task, and because the trust, once again, the trust was there, it's an established group, this is not a foreign concept to them assessing. We did not have to start with scratch with our group. What we did have to do is build on our group, because everyone knows as time goes on, you lose focus. The different collaboratives chose to go in different directions because there was very little leadership. When in those groups, after they were established, they just got their mission, and each group mirrored their community, which made them all a little bit different. So in June of 2006, in preparation for this, the community coordinator's job was to meet with the 13 collaboratives, and then those fold into four regional summits for us to address the function of each one, to standardize them, to develop our common goals, and establish protocols. So we felt like we had a leg up because we already had the groups, and all we had to do was take stock of our groups and then start adding membership to them.
Thanks, Melanie.
Thanks, Melanie. I also wanted to mention that we were going to have Sue Haight from West Virginia on this as well. She works with Melanie, and but the governor wanted to see her, so he gets first dibs.
True.
Okay, so I'm going to go back now to slide 23, and, you know, in step three, which is the first meeting of this community stakeholder collaborative, and at that full-day meeting, basically we present the child and family snapshot, so everybody who is in participating gets as clear a picture as possible about what we know about the kids and families who are coming into child welfare in their jurisdiction and what's bringing them in, and if possible, what kind of services are we utilizing at this point in time. We do some training, and then we, as a whole group, we perform the first assessment as an example so people can see how this thing works. I'll talk about that. And then we break them up for the assessment into five different work groups. Now, you'll see on slide 23 that the five work groups break up the seven outcomes and the capacities needed for each of the seven CFSR outcomes. Now, not all jurisdictions who do the service array process take on the entire CFSR outcome. So I'll talk more about that toward the end, but I wanted to point that out. So the next slide, 23, 24, 25, they just talk about the different capacities. And these are the slide 24, the two safety outcomes. Slide 25 is the first permanency outcome. Slide 26 is the second permanency outcome. 27 is the first well-being. And 28 and 29 is the well-being outcomes 2 and 3. In these work groups, we train the chairs of the work group to facilitate the meeting, and then we train recorders in the work groups to take very detailed notes of the work group's assessment, and that those recorders assist in producing the typed documents. On slide 30, what we're going to talk about here is the four different kinds of assessments that will take place in the work groups. And they have about 6 weeks, 2 months to complete their assessments, and then we reconvene for the second meeting. And the first assessment is assessment of the current practices in the jurisdiction as they relate to the capacity the work group is assessing. So if they're doing safety one, for example. And by practice, I mean we want to get a picture of what practice looks like in that jurisdiction. Child welfare practice, for example, are there family group decision-making practices taking place in that jurisdiction? Is family group decision-making a practice of the child welfare agency and the other provider agencies or not? Those kinds of things, because practice really is critical for achieving effective outcomes. The second assessment that we do, and these are all spelled out in some of those tools that I talked about, the very specific questions the work groups use to assess. The second assessment is the current leadership and systemic culture in their jurisdiction. For example, is the culture such that people collaborate across service silos? Is the culture in the jurisdiction such that providers do whatever it takes to get the outcomes that are needed? So that's the second assessment. The third assessment focuses on the current services in the jurisdiction, and we're going to look at a number of things. How is the service under a current service? Is it available throughout the whole jurisdiction? Does it meet all of the need or some of the need? What is the quality of that service? How important is it to continue that service? Again, these are all spelled out in an assessment protocol that the work groups use. And then the fourth assessment is based on the capacity being assessed. For example, if you're assessing permanency capacity, the capacity of the jurisdiction to achieve permanency for children, are there some services that do not exist in the jurisdiction that are really critical in helping to achieve permanency? So, for example, there may be a service called Family Finders, so that when it looks clear that a child's not going to be able to go back to the birth family, you have somebody who's whose full-time job is just to find relatives who might be able to provide care for this child on a permanent basis. So those are the four assessments.
And Steve, if this is John, let me just add one thing. And when you're doing those assessments, you really have, they have to be data-driven assessments, and that's why that child and family snapshot that Joe talked about is really important, because constantly when we're looking at these assessments and trying to assess a service or a practice, we're always wanting people to refer back to the data to make sure that the data is telling us how we qualitatively see the assessment of a practice or of a service.
Thanks, John. I'm glad you remember that, because I got too much in my mind at the moment. So if you look at slide 31, then those work groups continue to work. They each produce four reports on each of the capacities that they've been assigned, the ones I just covered. And then we take those four reports and we consolidate them into one assessment report. And we have a toolkit that will provides a format and template. Melanie, can you talk a little bit about now how this in the first implementing side in West Virginia, how this went?
I can. Thank you, Steve. We in West Virginia, we decided we were going to assess across the state and all seven capacities. So it was decided with the help of the Resource Center that we would have a first implementer, and we call them 4Cs. It was actually just one of our community collaboratives, and then we did three rounds that follow with four of the remaining collaboratives. And some of the issues that we had with the process was that we had the process in theory and in concept, but how do you sit down and actually do this with a group of people? So our first attempt, first issue that we had was we gave a two-month period, and we found out that when you're dealing with a group of volunteers across agencies, you know, and family members, that you cannot ask for that much of their time. They were used to meeting once a month for 2 hours, and to complete this process, they were having to meet at least once a week, and it was just too much. So the first thing we did was we pushed the time back and gave them a four-month period, and they were able to complete it then. They also had issues with geographic issues, because driving to get together in the different capacities was an issue, and we also had a problem with membership. People's employers were only willing to give so much of their time to this process, so we were constantly having to build back the community steering teams and the community stakeholder team membership, which is something that we assigned a person to at the very beginning of the process. We had thought about that ahead of time and had one person's job it was to always be looking for membership to back up the membership that was currently working on the process. One of the most important issues with the 4Cs is that they were a group that had a history of working together and had trust, and going through this process, which is very tedious and it's a very difficult process, it taxed their relationship as a group. And I think they would say that. And we were very happy that they had the history and of working together, because they needed that to get through this process.
Thank you, Melanie.
You're welcome.
Excuse me, Melanie. This is Mary O'Brien. What the 4Cs are again?
The 4Cs was our implementation group, and what it really was, it was one collaborative. We decided to do it across the state with 13 collaboratives. So we chose one collaborative that went first, and then the rest of them went together in rounds.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Let me just say that West Virginia, as a system of care state, really had some tremendous advantages in undertaking this process, because, in effect, they already had a state-level steering committee that they could use, and then they had their 13 collaboratives around the state already up and running. So that's a tremendous advantage, the 4Cs, that's just the name of that first collaborative that did the implementation.
Right, and we also have four regional summits. We call them the Child and Family Summits. and children's summits, and our collaboratives feed into the summits, and then now they feed into the state steering team. It was already in place, and it just worked really nicely to use them.
Okay, let's go to John now, and John, take us through the rest of the steps in the service array process.
Okay, after the assessment process that Melanie was and Steve were just talking about, there's going to be step four on slide 32. You're going to have that assessment process all the way leading up to the second meeting of the collaborative. And like Melanie said, we have 2 months in here, but it can take longer, as Melanie discussed. And at the second meeting, the work groups that are built around the seven capacities, they present their assessments. And there's discussion, there's feedback, and any recommendations from the large collaborative on maybe any integration or any patterns that are seen. And this is an opportunity for everybody to provide input because they will have been focused in on one or two capacities within a work group. So after this presentation process at this second meeting, then the work groups are reconvened and they begin the creation of the resource and capacity development plan, which is discussed on slide 33. And there's a little bit here about what's entailed in this plan. And this plan involves reforming current practices to enhance the capacities, strategies to improve systemic culture to enhance the capacities, enhancing current services to meet a jurisdiction's capacities, to meet the individualized needs of children and families. It also can discuss utilization estimates for new services that are decided that may be needed, and then also incorporating a continuous quality improvement process to evaluate the capacity and the outcomes. Slide 34 really discusses between the second and third meeting. So after that second full meeting, the work groups go about their, and meet for the next couple months, several months, and they're really working on this resource and capacity development plan for their particular capacities that they're looking at in their work group. And here in this first bullet on slide 34, there's seven different things that are needed in the resource and capacity development plan for each strategy. So the goal of the strategy, the second is the action steps of the strategy, the third are the tasks to complete the strategy, the fourth is the time frames for the completion of the strategy, what are the intended effects of the strategy, and then how we're going to monitor the metrics or the outcomes so that we can have continuous quality improvement for the strategy. And then the seventh one are persons and groups responsible for the strategy. So once the work groups meet in between the second and third meetings, they'll prepare a presentation for the third meeting in which the strategies are presented back to the stakeholder collaborative. Step five is on slide 35. And at the third meeting, which says here it's held 2 months after the second meeting, and the timeline is flexible again, each work group presents the strategies for their respective group's capacities. And then there's discussion because there can be discrepancies between the different work groups. There could be some overlap where some strategies need to be combined, so there's some integration into the resource and capacity development plan. Step six on slide 36 is the adoption of the resource capacity development plan. And once it's adopted, it's reviewed by the state steering committee and the community steering committee. And then an implementation plan of selected priorities is created and agreed to by the two steering committees. Over on slide 37, there's oftentimes recommendations and priorities regarding services, so sometimes we need to do utilization estimates, costs, financing strategies, contracting methodologies, et cetera, have to be identified and pursued. And then we begin the implementation implementation monitoring process and schedule those meetings. And then step seven, slide 38, is the actual implementation process. And throughout this, we want to monitor and evaluate how we're implementing the strategies that were created in the resource development plan, continue evaluation of funding strategies, and then implementation work groups. So a lot of times the work groups that did the assessment and then developed the strategy, task work groups can be created to assist in the implementation of prioritized initiatives. And these meetings also can be used to, for any barriers can be discussed and successes celebrated. You want to talk about the timeline, Steve?
Yeah, I'll talk about that now. If you look, take a look at slide, we're almost done with the PowerPoint, folks, so we'll open this up in a minute to questions and discussion. But if you look at slides 39 and 40, there's a sort of a typical timeline for the full process, beginning with the first contact with the regional office and the National Resource Centers, all the way through the quarterly meetings focused on collaborate on implementation of the plan. So that's 20 months to get from the beginning if you can stay on schedule. And of course, let me also say we've done this process now in multiple states, and it's never been the same in any two states. We have to adapt it. But even if we stayed on the schedule kind of strictly, that's 20 months to get into from the beginning to four quarterly meetings on implementation. And as Melanie can tell you, this is not a process for the faint-hearted. I mean, it's a very, very intensive process that can be exhausting, almost as exhausting as the Child and Family Services review. But if it's done right, it can be a transformational process. It really can transform service delivery in the jurisdiction. So, but we wanted to give you that so you had some sort of notion of the time frame for it.
Steve,
there's two other things I'm going to cover yet before we finish very briefly.
Steve, this is Paul. Can I just add something and just reinforce something you just said?
Please, Paul. Go ahead.
I think we've found, especially in West Virginia from our work there in Maryland, that unless you have a person designated either locally or at the state level or both to manage it, it really does not get done because people will not take responsibility. They'll feel as if it's maybe over and above their daily job, even though this is the work that we do, you know, trying to improve our system. There really needs to be a person whose job it is to move it along. Melanie's done a great job of that in West Virginia, but even having one person sometimes has been a challenge, and I don't know if you want to comment on that.
I do. I feel like you have to have at least one person and a tremendous staff behind that one person, and then you have to have work groups that are just ready to jump in and be adaptable because, you know, you're looking for quality here, and if it takes 4 months to get quality, we need quality. We don't need quick. We need quality.
Good point, Melanie. And you know, at the level of the community stakeholder collaborative, it really requires intensive community organizing to engage those stakeholders and keep them coming to the table. So John Bumgardner did this process in a pilot county in Virginia. Pulaski County is a population of about 30,000 people. And at the beginning of the process, we had 60 stakeholders involved. And by the time we got into implementation, we had 90 stakeholders involved. But that took full-time work to get those people to the table and keep them there. There's two other things I want to just cover briefly before we end the PowerPoint. On slide 41, there are some places now that are creating regional and state assessments and regional and state plans. Some states are beginning to experiment in developing these plans. For example, in Maryland, the Eastern Shore counties have all completed the assessments and plans and are now looking at region-wide trends and needs with the goal of working with the region's legislators, both local and state, to increase the resources on the Eastern Shore. Maryland is also planning on the completion of the process in all 24 of its jurisdictions, and by that they mean Baltimore City and the 23 counties, and then looking at the statewide trends and needs. And then finally, I wanted to just point out what I alluded to earlier. There are maybe jurisdictions that do not want to or need to assess all the child welfare capacities listed in the one of the tools that we have on our website. For example, a jurisdiction that has undergone the Child and Family Services review can decide to adapt the service array process as part of its program improvement plan to assess only those non-conforming outcomes or capacities and to create a plan to improve capacities in those areas. Or, for example, a jurisdiction has identified the need to build capacities to support its efforts to implement portions of its system, such as reducing children in residential care can choose to assess these those select capacities. So you don't have to do all seven. I mean, if you feel like you can benefit from all seven, fine. But if you can start smaller and then double back if you need to. And that very last slide is my contact information if anybody wants to call me and talk in more depth. Now, Denise, can you open this up now and ask people if they have any questions or comments or concerns that they'd like to talk about?
Certainly. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or if you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key.
I can't believe there wouldn't be any questions when there's 43 slides.
Our first question comes from Gwen Monroe.
Gwen, could you say where you're from?
Yes, I'm from Frederick County, Virginia. And can you repeat again how you did this and who is responsible in Pulaski County, Virginia?
Yes, this is now 2-3 years ago, but the state of Virginia was interested at that time in perhaps doing this process in multiple jurisdictions. The Pulaski volunteered to be the pilot, and the state contracted with Virginia Tech University and an institute of Virginia Tech to help Pulaski County to go through the process. And John Bumgardner at that time was at Virginia Tech. But the DSS director in Pulaski County was really responsible for that. John, help me with the name.
Jim Wallace. Okay.
And it was Lynette Isbell who had to give permission so that we could go to the federal regional office and get – I'm going to talk about that in a minute when we talk about technical assistance, but get permission for the resource centers to help.
Thank you very much.
Again, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. I'm not showing any questions at this time.
All right, well, then I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about technical assistance to help with this process. As you can see from the presentation, it's a very intensive process, and the two resource centers are very happy to help states do this, but we also have limited capacity. So typically what's happened, and I'll just describe again West Virginia, since they're on the line, but this is how it's worked in other jurisdictions as well. West Virginia called their federal regional officer in Philadelphia because the federal regional offices are the gatekeepers for technical assistance from the 8 national resource centers, and said that they were interested in talking about getting some help doing a service array assessment in West Virginia. Melanie had come across the information on our website. The federal regional office gave permission for them to go forward to develop a work plan. And what the national resource centers then do is they help the state set up or enhance a state-level steering committee. We provide technical assistance then to help that state-level steering committee recruit a pilot jurisdiction to go through the process. In West Virginia, they don't call them pilots. They call them first implementers. And then the National Resource Centers go and help that pilot implement the process from beginning to end, even if it takes us 2 years or longer. And that's what we're doing in West Virginia at the 4 C's. As we help them do that, West Virginia is phasing in the other jurisdictions in waves or phases. So 4 C's is the first phase. The second phase, I don't remember how many, Melanie, you may be able to tell me, say 3 or 4 regional collaboratives are going to do it next. So they came along for the ride at 4 C's to see it in process. So the resource centers really only stay with the pilot. Now, they'll continue to provide technical assistance to the state steering committee and the state staff as they roll it out. And then as this phase two regional collaboratives in West Virginia begin implementing the process, then the phase three come along for the ride to see how it works. Did I describe that accurately for West Virginia, Melanie?
Yes.
So our technical assistance of the resource centers is really to the state and then to the first site. And that technical assistance is both on the process and the products of the assessment and the plan, as well as the child and family snapshot. Does my team, Paul, John, Joe, Melanie, do you have anything to add to that?
No.
Joe, do you want to say a little bit about the technical assistance from your resource center?
Well, as I mentioned before, we do have the utility available in SPSS syntax that the state can use to draw the core data for the child and family snapshot from their NCANS and AFCAR submissions. And there are not only the syntax but directions for its use that I can make available to anybody that cares to have that.
Okay. Denise, why don't you open it up again now and see if people have any questions on technical assistance.
Again, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone.
This is Mary O'Brien, a question or a comment on any of the material as well.
Our next question comes from Russ Conti.
Hey, Russ.
Hey, Steve.
Russ is a good colleague from South Dakota. I was just with him last week.
Hey, Steve. Thanks. I guess this is a question for Joe regarding the snapshot. We're helping work with our pilot out in Yankton with a collaborative circle. And you could, if I email you, you'd be able to give me a picture of what that might look like?
Sure. I can give you a copy of the blank Excel workbook that is produced containing that core data. And also, we have one of our materials is a description of the child and family snapshot with a number of examples of additional data or information that you might want to include in the template.
Joe, Russ already has the service array binder, so he's got those materials.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Yeah, but if you'd like me to, you know, if you'd like to contact me, I'll be glad to kind of walk you through those.
That'd be perfect.
And Joe's email address, Russ, is on the agenda there.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
I'm not showing any further questions at this time.
Okay, then I'm going to just talk one more minute here about our website, because I mentioned to you that there are 50-plus tools and documents on that website, and I think they would be tremendously helpful. I'll just give you a couple examples. Be very helpful to states or jurisdictions that are interested in doing this. For example, we have for both the state steering committee and the community steering committee a matrix of tasks that they need to do to complete their work. And when those tasks are filled out with dates and persons responsible, you really, in effect, have a work plan already developed for completing your tasks. We have agendas for each of the meetings of the Community Stakeholder Collaborative. We have the invitation, a copy of an invitational letter. We have 10 what we call mini modules to train the State Steering Committee and the Community Stakeholder Group in areas of emerging child welfare practice that they may not know enough about that they feel would be helpful for them to do their work. For example, we have one on evidence-based practice in child welfare. We have one on developing practice models in child welfare. We have one on what's the difference between a practice and a service. We have one on prevention in child welfare. Those mini modules can be used for training. By the way, this stuff is all in the public domain, so you're free to download it and use it in any way that you see fit, and you can modify it because the documents are in Word. They're not Adobe. They're modifiable. Does my team want to add anything about the tools on the website?
Only what you just said, Steve. This is Paul. Just to say that, you know, they're really good and helpful practical tools, but they can be modified to, you know, accommodate a local jurisdiction if they're, you know, maybe too far advanced, or maybe they're, you know, ahead of this process already and they want to make it a little more sophisticated. They can do that.
Steve, this is Melanie. I just wanted to say that we have used the 10 mini modules in the collaboratives to educate people on what is child welfare, particularly when you're bringing in law enforcement and different and mayors and delegates that have not traditionally been with the group. And we set those up and let them run during meetings so that people can choose to go over and watch those. I also have used those mini modules, all 10 of them, to help educate the legislature here. I just used it to help update for Sue to take to the governor on what is child welfare, the difference between a practice and a service, because those are the questions that people have, and you know, you need to have a quick, easy answer. And those mini modules are perfect for that.
That's great. I'm glad to hear you use them like that. I tell you, we're learning so much from Washington, helping West Virginia do this, and they're doing just such a great job.
Thank you.
Denise, I'm going to give people one more opportunity to ask questions or make comments. I'd really be curious to hear from people about how feasible they think this would be for them to do in their state.
Again, if you have a question or comment at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. I'm not showing any questions or comments at this time.
Steve, this is Mary O'Brien. I think that's a really good question to raise to people who are on the line. And I wondered about the woman from Virginia who spoke up and asked about the county that had done it a couple of years ago. And let me just... I mean, I'm wondering about whether Virginia counties are thinking about getting engaged in this again, and what happened a couple years ago when that one county did do a pilot. You guys may be able to tell us in terms of how far that went. But I'm also thinking about West Virginia, and could I just ask the Melanie, maybe could you tell us, you talked about how you've started with you've had your local committee doing all the seven capacities with the work groups and doing those four different assessments. And you talked about how that has been difficult and challenging in terms of the amount of time it's taken and the issues in terms of distance and getting people together and tasking their relationships a little bit. Can you tell us about what's been positive in that process for you, like what you feel you've gotten out of it that makes it worth going through those difficulties of getting those assessments done? I'm just kind of curious at your perspective on that. It might help other people who are thinking about whether they can undertake this process.
Well, yeah, I would love to speak about that. Although it's been difficult, and I think everyone should understand how difficult it is so worth it. And our collaboratives and everyone who's been approached with this project really understand how worth it is because in their mind, even if the state ignores the data and doesn't change practice or doesn't change the way they deliver, part of the process generates a community plan, and they see value in the fact that they can just take their community plan and through grants and faith-based and local initiatives build up their communities, even if the state and the mental health fall short of the goals of doing a strategic plan. The people that work together on this in the collaboratives say that they feel like this is a gift. And maybe they went into child welfare to give this gift back to the community that they live in. It's really been very difficult, but a very meaningful, very worthwhile endeavor for them.
This is Steve. Let me just add to build on what Melanie had to say. If this process is done right, it can be transformational in a jurisdiction. And the way you can tell whether it's transformational or not is in the beginning, the stakeholders will say to you, why isn't the agency doing such and such? And over a period of time, it begins to transform so that people say, how can we as a community make sure that we get the service that we need? And it's not only the assessment and the resource and capacity development plan that happens here, but it's the collaboration that begins to happen between stakeholders and providers. In one jurisdiction, for example, three different providers were providing parent education. You know, that's the typical thing we build into the case plan when there's been abuse or neglect. Well, in this jurisdiction, three different providers were providing parent education, and frankly, all of it stunk, and it all looked alike, whether the family had neglected their children or physically abused or sexually abused their children. So they, on their own, without the state doing it, those three providers got together and said, you know, the quality of our stuff isn't very good, and one size fits all. We need to be able to individualize this. So one began to specialize in parent education for neglect. One began to specialize when there is neglect or abuse with teenagers and so forth. So that's the kind of transformation that can take place.
Denise, this is Mary O'Brien. Just make sure that Denise has got the lines open. So if anybody wants to comment or, you know, get into the discussion, just press number one. Denise, interrupt us and let us know.
Okay, no problem.
I also, to your question, Mary, unfortunately in Virginia, there was Pulaski remained the only county that did it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Melanie. I have to just say that's exactly why we rolled it out. We did not do a pilot. We traditionally will pilot something, and for some reason it will be dropped, no matter what the outcome of, you know, the assessment would have been. And so we decided to not take that chance in West Virginia.
And for Gwen in Frederick County, Virginia, I mean, I'm sure if you contact Jim Wallace down in Pulaski County that, you know, he'd give you as much information as you wanted. I know when I left the process, we had, you know, we had completed the entire assessment, which was about a 90-page report. And then we also had completed the resource development plan, which had about 32 or 33 strategies in it. And they were in the process of creating a commission on children and families for the county that was going to be kind of the guiding commission for implementing those priorities or strategies. So that's where it was, I'd say, about 2 years ago.
And this is Melanie. I just wanted to say that we have taken on the service array in West Virginia with I'm basically the only staff person that's paid to work on the service array, and that's about a quarter of my total job requirements. I have a lot of volunteers. I have taken master-level students to help me, VISTA students. Anybody I can get to help, I have conned into copying and pasting and working on this project. So, and also no budget. There's not a budget. We're not in the budget this year, and I don't know if we're in the budget next year. So, you know, if you're thinking about it statewide, that you would have to start with a big budget and with staff, that would be really nice to have a staff and budget, but it can be done without it. It's difficult, and it worries Paul a lot, doesn't it, Paul?
Sure does.
Just to follow up on that, in Maryland, the state office made available a stipend for each county. It wasn't a large stipend, but it was a stipend that they could use to help convene the community stakeholders in each county and to develop the reports.
Pardon me, we have a question from Jason Bond.
Hey, Steve.
Hey, Jason.
Yeah, I had a question about you. What you and the team thought about integrating this, say, with the development of a GIS system so that when they got done looking at their whole service array across their areas, that they ended up with a tool that the workers could use and access those, you know, just have a listing of them and then be able to keep track and update it over time.
And Steve, or I can partially answer that. This is John. I know Maryland is using that type of technology throughout the service array process, especially in some of it in its urban counties. So when they're actually building that child and family snapshot, they already have the tool, and they're using that to really document where the need is and then really focus in on those particular types of things.
Now, Jason, I'm glad John spoke up because I didn't know what those initials meant. So, you know, one thing that was kind of interesting, Kathy Moles, who is in the Maryland system who runs child welfare, said in conjunction with the service array process, they've been mapping out where their kids are, and they found out that the Baltimore City kids, the majority of them were way over in Prince George's County near the District of Columbia, so there was no contact happening with their families. So they developed the model Place Matters, and that all came out of the service array process.
Yeah, it was really interesting in Maryland because we did all the shore counties, the service array process, and then moved over towards Baltimore and the county of Baltimore, And it was interesting, the county of Baltimore were sending over half their kids to the shore, and the shore was sending over half their kids to Baltimore County. And that was the whole impetus behind the Place Matters for Kathy in the state of Maryland.
Just to go back to Jason's question, though, I think that that something we didn't really incorporate a whole lot into the process, but I think you could, is for those jurisdictions that have GIS capacity, you should really use that, I think, in the service array planning process. It can be as valuable as the data that Joe can assist with, because you can see very graphically, you know, exactly where the kids and families are coming from, and then also then do a match-up of what services exist in those communities. And there's a couple of jurisdictions around the country that have tried that and have done a pretty good job of it, actually.
Okay, this is your last chance for questions or comments, Denise.
I'm not showing any further questions.
Well, all right, then. I think we'll end this call a bit early. It's about 3:45 Eastern time.
I'm sorry, sir. We do have a question or comment from Gwen Monroe.
Okay, Gwen, could you say where you're from?
I'm the same person who talked from Frederick County, Virginia, which surrounds Winchester. I just wanted to express appreciation. It just so happens that the Commissioner of Social Services will be in Winchester and will be meeting with some of us at 6 o'clock today. And the State Board of Social Services will be here Wednesday and Thursday. So I just wanted to express appreciation. We do have a committee locally. We're trying to do this. We're buying each other pizza and just doing it on our own. And this, you're giving us great tools to use.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
That's great. Yep, that's great. There's a lot of good resources out there you can draw on.
Great. Thanks.
All right, I'm going to end the call now, and I'm going to ask the panelists if we were going to end at the same time. Could we stay on a few more minutes?
Great, thank you. And I'll just say, this is Mary O'Brien. I just want to ask everyone who was on the line as a participant, if you could please fill out the evaluation for today's call. That's a link to an online evaluation form that was in the email that you got with the call-in information. You should also get another email today with that link. So we'd appreciate it if you give us any feedback on the teleconference today, any suggestions you might have for how these could be improved. We do use those and take a look at those. So that we'd appreciate it if you would fill out that evaluation. Thanks very much. And Steve, we should just say thank you to everyone for presenting today. Thanks to Steve and to Joe Murray from the Resource Center for Child Welfare Data and Technology, and to John Baumgartner and Paul DiLorenzo. It's great you could join us. And Melanie Fisher from West Virginia, thank you so much for giving us that perspective from West Virginia. That was really helpful. So thank you, everyone, for presenting today, and thanks, everyone, for participating as well. We look forward to hearing from you in the future.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's conference. This concludes the program. You may now disconnect. Thank you and have a great day.